Hello and welcome back to Back in My Play. This is episode number 41, and we're talking about an interesting game this week with Shin Shinobi Den, if you're in Japan, or Shinobi Legions, if you're in the Western territories. This came out on the Sega Saturn at a very interesting time of the Sega Saturn's lifespan, and I have two great people to talk to about this game. I'm going to first apologize to them before I introduce them, because I was not aware of the second half of this game and how crazy it can get. But first off, from GameSpot.com, the I don't know if I call you like the resident like retro gaming expert over there, but I'm just always a big fan of your stuff because whenever you're on, you're always talking about retro stuff and bringing a huge box of old carts to the set to play games. And of course, that's Peter Brown. Peter, how are you doing?
Great, man. Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Yeah, this is Sega Saturn. We got to talk to you about. I mean, this is a console we cannot talk enough about, and oddly enough, this is going to be the very first Sega Saturn game that's ever talked about on the show, and the resident Sega expert from Generation 16, which you should be supporting on Patreon if you are not already, and of course, the Player One podcast that is Greg Seward up in Canada. Greg, how you doing?
Good, thanks. Yeah. Oh, one addendum to your intro.
Sure.
It was also known as Shinobi X over in UK. Great.
That's correct. I was going to get to that. I have it in the outline.
All right.
But, you know, thanks for throwing me under the bus.
Yep, no problem.
All right, there's we put in a lot of music in this show, and we're going to break the segment right now and go into some music. And when I talked about this game on Twitter and saying that we were going to do it, half the people told me, oh, you got to make sure you use the European version of this soundtrack. But I played the Japanese version, and I quite enjoyed the soundtrack for the most part, except for Stage 6. So I'm going to do my best. I'm going to try to put in both of the soundtracks in the game and see what tracks that I like, and you'll have to just guess which ones that we use. But we'll talk about the soundtrack in a second. But until then, here's some music from the Japanese version of the game, Shin Shinobi Den. Stick around. We'll be right back. Alright, so let's talk about the history of Shinobi Legions, Shin Shinobi Den, Shinobi X, Greg. If you're in Europe, I mean, we have so many European listeners, and we actually do. Like, it's surprising how many people were watching me play this game at like 8 o'clock last night on Twitch, and then said, "Hey, it's 3:30 in the morning. I should probably go to bed." And like, you should never stay up and watch someone play video games until 3:30 in the morning, unless it's for charity. But this game. Oh my God, this is a very interesting game because it came out June 30th, 1995 in Japan. I don't have exact dates for North America, but it also came out in 95 in North America and in Europe. So you can guess probably around June, maybe closer towards the fall season that those games came out. And it was developed by Sega and it was published by Sega in Japan. But in the United States, it was actually published by Vic Tokai, who... Mm-hmm. I mean, they brought over lots of games from Japan to the United States, did a lot of localization, and Vic is an actual guy. Is that correct?
Really?
Yeah.
No.
Oh, is not?
No.
Okay, never mind. Maybe I'm thinking of someone else from like hearing in Retronauts or something like
isn't
that.
Isn't Victor Kai, I think, is a part of Victor Music Industries or something like that?
That sounds about right.
Okay, yeah. You guys are right. Yeah, you're right. You're right. So maybe I didn't have enough caffeine today, but
I couldn't tell if you were making a joke or if you're.
No, you know, I have an Uncle Vic. There's plenty of people named Vic. Come on, Victor.
We tend to create alliterative names in the office for companies, like in their owners, like Steve Samsung. And, yeah.
Joe Panasonic.
I'm with you. I buy it.
Joey Panasonic, man. He's got the best plasmas in the industry. So let's talk a little bit about the development history, because I mentioned before that there's differences in the music, but there's actually a lot of differences between these two games, between this game throughout the regions, I should say. So I'm going to just drop some stuff on you. The European version of Shinobi Legions, published by Sega Europe and renamed Shinobi X, Greg, was delayed and released in late 1995. It was due to the fact that Sega Europe's producer, David Nulty, disliked the original music score and wanted to change it for the European release in a similar way that Sega of America did years before with the North American version of Sonic CD. So that is how I wanted to relate it to earlier Sega releases, that you did actually have some people that are like, I like the US version, I like the Japanese soundtrack. You know what? They're both pretty good for Sonic CD, but I can understand your viewpoints. For the soundtrack, I got some more info, because the whole in-game tracks were replaced by noted British video game composer Richard Jacques.
Thank you.
I didn't take French class. I was in Spanish class and getting C's. While the cutscene music tracks were left intact, it's just Jack. What did you guys say? It was Jack?
Jacques.
You think I'd do bad with Japanese names. French names is not going to happen. Composed this soundtrack in imitation of the style of Yuzo Koshiro's The Revenge of Shinobi. So I got a quote from Richard. He said, what happened was that they had done the Japanese version, and the producer in Sega Europe said that he didn't like the music and he wanted to change it. So he played it for me and said, can you redo the music for this? The only difficult thing was it had to be done on the sound chip instead of the CD. So they had to use the sound chip they just didn't drop a bunch of, you know, music on the disc, like CD music on the disc. And he says, I only had 2 weeks to do the whole game that consisted of about 20 tunes. I only had 200K of memory to play with as well. So, you know, some constraints there, but definitely some crazy differences between the two games. I also wanted to mention that there were some differences in the cutscenes as well, but I do not have the two games to compare side by side, so I'm not going to go into too much detail, unless you do, Greg.
The key thing about the cutscenes, I actually was watching video of the UK version today, and it looked like it was pretty much intact, but in the US, a lot of the cutscenes were just really shortened or deleted altogether.
You know what? They probably needed to be honest. Some of them run a little long. The game consists of 9 total stages that take you throughout Japan to such locations as Kyoto, Mount Fuji, which is a beautiful second level, crazy laboratories. You get to go into caves. They played, obviously a lot of Donkey Kong Country, because you get to do a minecart stage. You go to the jungle, then you go to China, to the Hong Kong Harbor. You finish off in the mountains, and then you go to Kazuma's Fortress. The story for this game is quite interesting, because it's nuts. It's I'm just going to paraphrase it by saying, all right, there's these two people that are studying under this master, and then there's other guy that was studying under the master. One of the guys wanted to learn the secret technique. The master didn't want to teach it to them. He got pissed, so he, you know, vowed to have revenge on him. So he kidnaps the female student, and then one of the male students needs to go after him and, get her back. You know, have to rescue the damsel in distress, like every other video game that came out in the last 30 years. So the story is told in these cutscenes. So if you really want to get a hold of it, you can watch the FMV cutscenes, which seem to have been done with a... if I'm being generous, a high 8 camcorder. with the microphone that was built into the camera. They did not seem to have any actual pro level audio equipment, because you can hear things like echoing in the, when they're in warehouses, and when they're outside, you can clearly hear just like just all these distracting noises. You can hear wind, like they just didn't, the production quality was not there. I want to mention some reviews that Famicom Tushin scored the game a 26 out of 40. Although Shinobi Legions boasted improved graphics and superior sound, it was unfavorably reviewed because of the limited use of the then new hardware's capabilities, and its use of live action cutscenes was much ridiculed for what was considered poor acting. No crap. Sega Saturn Magazine gave the game. Oh no! This, like, you have to see this stuff, and it's almost, I almost, if you want to say, okay, you got Night Trap. Let's say everyone knows Night Trap, right? And you know Sewer Shark. This is way below those two. And it's like, if you've seen a Japanese soap opera, it is like a soap opera that was directed by 3-year-olds. And, you know, the, like I said, the equipment was not very high quality. And this is why I kind of wanted to play the game for the show. It's just a weird game that I think people should at least check out. Sega Saturn Magazine gave the game a 3 out of 5 stars, saying that it plays well, but fails to make any real use of the Saturn's capabilities, calling it, quote, another Shinobi game that somehow managed to find its way on the CD instead of a cartridge. They suggested that the tacky FMV scenes were added simply as an excuse to release the game on the Saturn instead of the Sega Genesis. And they might be right. Like, this could have probably been like a Sega CD game, maybe not Sega Genesis game, but maybe Sega CD. But it is it's one of those properties that you need to take advantage of. Another thing that people mentioned in reviews is that it was very similar to Shinobi 3 on the Genesis, but it did implement some new gameplay techniques that allow for some fun and enjoyable action, slashing and cutting dudes in half. So, wow, this is, it's kind of a weird game, but I don't know. Greg, do you have anything else that you would want to add in there in terms of the history? I don't know if you looked up any more stuff on this.
Not in terms of the history. I mean, I assume that we'll be talking about the cutscenes and stuff a little bit later.
Of course.
A little more later, yeah. One thing I do want to, I've been looking this up while you've been talking about the history. I was wrong. Vic Tokai is actually a subsidiary of Tokai, which is a telecommunications company in Japan. I was thinking of JVC when I said Victor Music.
I must be thinking of Victor Ireland.
There you go.
Is that a person?
Unky Vic? Victor Ireland. He was the head of Working Designs.
Yeah. Have you had a Working Designs episode yet?
No.
Like Lunar? No? You should. Yeah.
Yeah.
I have a really fresh copy of Lunar that's in Japanese for the Sega Saturn. Lunar, the Silver Star Story.
Do you have the MPEG card for that?
Yeah, I was going to say.
Oh, damn it. That's what it meant when it said MPEG on the case.
Yep.
But I can't just use my 4 megabyte action replay?
No, that's a totally different thing.
For the videos.
God. Yeah. Man. Okay, you want to talk about some BS. Like, I remember having a Lenovo laptop. Not Lenovo. It was an IBM ThinkPad, and you had to get this special, like, magic something card to play DVDs out of your DVD player. It had, like, a 4 megabyte RAM booster, so you could actually play DVDs on that thing. But that's not what we're here to talk about. Peter, I don't know if you have anything else, like, just in terms of stuff about this game that you wanted to mention before we go into the next segment.
No, I think you pretty much covered it all. This was a game I found out kind of years after the fact. So, yeah, I don't really have much background to share, unfortunately.
I think we can mention it right here is that they did not, they clearly did not advertise this game aggressively in the United States. Like, I never saw this when I was actively craving a Sega Saturn at Funko Land so I could play copies of Die Hard Arcade and Virtual Fight or Virtual Cop. So, Sega failed. So, we'll take a break and we'll be right back with our memories and our personal history with this crazy Shinobi game. Stick around. this segment is going to be dominated quite a bit by Greg, because Peter and myself did not play this game in 1995 or even before the Sega Saturn was in its grave. So, Greg, I need to ask you, like, what were your thoughts when you played this game? Were you like, this is almost like VCD quality video coming out of my Sega Saturn?
Yeah, I mean, it was a weird. It was kind of tough at the time because you got to remember the atmosphere, especially if you were a Saturn owner in mid to late 95, was not good. You know, they launched early in May, and then there was like nothing to play but bug for like 6 months. And then, you know, you got the second wave of games. And if I remember correctly, Shinobi Legions was part of the second wave of games in the US. So we were all kind of starving for something to play. And of course, if you were diehard Sega fan and you had a Genesis, you'd played like Revenge of Shinobi and Shadow Dancer and Shinobi 3 were all incredible games. So be totally honest, this game was really underwhelming back in the day, because it's trying to do everything that like Shinobi 3 did, but with digitized character graphics. And I don't know. I was really taken aback by it. It's just like, okay, this is something.
So at that time, this was a bit of a trend. Like it was kind of a running joke when I went to 8-4 and I brought them a mint, and they didn't appreciate it, a mint condition copy of a Batman Forever for the Sega Genesis, which also used the same kind of setup where you had these very much the sprites that would be like from a Mortal Kombat game, like these pre-rendered sprites, these digitized actors that were acting out all these moves, and you would just drop them into a video game. And at the time, That was a big deal because Mortal Kombat was one of the hottest properties on the video game market.
But see, that's the thing. That trend was kind of over by this time, I thought anyway. Like,
well, yeah, Mortal Kombat's 91, 92.
Yeah, and it had kind of decided, I mean, it still worked for Mortal Kombat, but it felt like it had, with things like Batman Forever, it had kind of been accepted that it wasn't really a great idea to do that in an action game. And I mean, the reason why I'm saying that is that, you know, the game plays just fine, but you talk about like side-scrolling games, especially starring ninja or ninja-like characters, and the moves that they do are so cool, you can't really replicate them in real life. You know, like you look at even the way that the character, like Shinobi in Shinobi 3, the way Joe Musashi runs, you can't really run that way. Like that animation is not realistic. It's just cool. Yeah. You know, and it's kind of, that's where it fell apart is like, you don't have sort of the superhero dimensions on the characters because he looks like a real dude. So, you know, you don't get sort of the overdone shoulders and the really thin waist and all that stuff. Like, and the other thing back in the day that kind of really killed it was, I think we all love the cutscenes because they were just ridiculous. I mean, they're ridiculous fun.
But did you think they were like, I want to ask you, as someone that had a Sega CD, was Night Trap, was that a cool looking game?
No.
Okay, so you even knew back then that this game is kind of not so hot.
Yeah, but I mean, the thing is this isn't a full motion video game. And at the same time, like this is, you got to remember like the 90s was when things like Power Rangers were blowing up on US television, right?
Yeah, so it was right there.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, and this totally has the same vibe as that. I mean, if you really go back and look at those shows, like, and I can't name more than like Masked Rider, I think is another one.
VR Troopers.
There you go. You go back and look at those shows, the live action stuff that is there is not really well done. And I'm not talking about the stuff that they did in the US to splice into the original Japanese shows. I'm talking about like the footage from the Japanese show itself. Like you can tell like a lot of times they don't really have a set. They found like a lot somewhere in a city that they get to, you know, they can pretend to fight in. And you know, the costumes are okay, but they're not great. And Shinobi Legions totally has that vibe going. It's like you said, it looks like it was filmed with a camcorder. Absolutely, it looks like it was filmed with a camcorder. Like the frame rate's all wrong and it doesn't have really good lighting. And you can tell half the time he's running through an empty factory. You know, like it's just, he's not in sets. He's just wherever they could put a camera. Like when he's in the forest, that's because they're really in a forest.
Yeah.
You know, but it's got that campy, stupid sort of same feel you were getting with those television shows back in the day. So it kind of fit that trend a little bit. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of watching it going like, wow, I can't even believe what I'm looking at, but I kind of like it, you know?
Yeah. It's the thing that Batman Forever had was the ultimate Cinefusion technology that allowed for real digitized characters to be dropped into amazing 3D rendered environments. At the time, Peter, were you like into any, or I should say, let me take a step back. Were any of these like digitized graphics, was that a thing that you were drawn towards? Like, did you see pictures of Sub-Zero Mythologies and say, I need to try this game, it looks so real? Or was that a turnoff for you?
It was more of a curiosity that mm-hmm. I think, it's funny you mentioned Sub-Zero, because that was one game that I always wanted to play because I couldn't imagine it being good at all. Mm-hmm. Very much sort of like a sideshow kind of thing. For me, Mortal Kombat was the game that introduced it and the one that I think encapsulated the best of it, even though it was one of the first games to really, I guess, do it well. They did it really well. So when it came to things like Pit Fighter or, you know, other games that did it,
Way of the Warrior?
Yeah, no, it just didn't do it for me. I had a really hard time with it. Even the pre-rendered 3D stuff as well.
Yeah.
Strange.
That totally, I totally sit this trend sort of in with that, because I feel the same way. Like, Sega was one of the worst offenders for that too, with sort of the pre-rendered sprites.
Oh yeah.
Ever since Donkey Kong Country, it's like they did that a lot in there, especially their RPGs mm-hmm. on the Saturn, and it never looked good.
Force? Are you kidding me?
Yeah, it never looked good. You know, like, ugh.
Well, it's funny that you guys say that stuff, and I would always be drawn to these games when I saw them in the local like video rental store. Whenever I saw games that were pushing the crap out of these consoles, for me, it was seeing the digitized graphics on the Super Nintendo. And I'm not going to use Donkey Kong Country as an example because that's a quality game. Mm. But even with stuff like games that were coming from the arcade and then being brought home with digitized like graphics like Revolution X, or whether it be any kind of fighting game. And even I'm trying to think, I don't know if it was digitized, but I played so much of War Gods because that was just a game that I had. So I always used to look for the most realistic looking graphics that I could get on these consoles. And I was getting away from the cartoony stuff. And of course, then I got an N64, so I didn't have a prayer getting anything out of that thing. But it's an interesting contrast to you guys. Maybe it was just because what I was looking at the time, lots of PC games for my brother's computer, I guess.
One other thing too, going back to when this came out, because you mentioned how it was published by Victokai, like it wasn't uncommon, especially in the late Genesis era where Sega games would be published by other companies mm-hmm. in the US. But being someone who paid attention to stuff like that back in 95, between this and Virtua Racing, because Virtua Racing was published by Time Warner Interactive.
No way.
Yeah. So that was published by Time Warner Interactive here, and
on the
Shinobi
Genesis.
Legions. No, on the
32X.
On the Saturn.
Oh, on the Saturn. Okay. The
Saturn version. And then on the Saturn as well, you had Shinobi Legions, which was Victokai. And it's like, okay, it's not weird to have third parties publishing Sega's games, but those are flagship games.
Of course, yeah.
You know, that was weird. It's like, why did they let Shinobi get published by Victokai? And in hindsight, it's like, okay, now we know that the Saturn was kind of where all the big Sega franchises from the 16-bit days went to die. Like, you know, they were, that was one of the things that really differentiated the Saturn from the Genesis, is like it felt like all of these properties that they built up on the Genesis mm-hmm. either had terrible sequels on the Saturn or just never came out. Like, I mean, Sonic is a great example, right? And it's like, okay, now I get it. It's like, it's almost like they just weren't, I don't know if they weren't into those franchises anymore, or they weren't, didn't have a lot of confidence in them anymore, or what, but like, it was so weird to see a Shinobi game being published by somebody other than Sega.
Sega was messed up at the time, man.
They like, were.
They were in... Well, sorry. My dog just knocked over my PlayStation 4 controller. Those are
That's
like
not
60
important.
Bucks. No, I don't need that for retro games. so, The last thing I wanted to bring up when it came to this discussion is did I really just lose my train of thought? I thought I had something really cool to talk about, but I might have lost it. It had to do with the Sega Saturn, and maybe I will, just so I can think about it for a second, toss it over to Peter. Peter, I want you to talk about Shinobi for you. Like, at the time, were you playing at least the other Shinobi games? Like, we had three of them on the Sega Genesis itself. Maybe it was just a case of, you know, the, you know, franchise fatigue or something like that.
No, Shinobi was not a series that I spent much time with. I had a Genesis growing up, but as I think I've mentioned on almost every episode of the show, I used to go to a friend's house and play Super Nintendo a lot. So I was sort of an ashamed Genesis owner.
Self-loathing Sega fan.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I didn't find Shinobi until maybe about, you know, 5 years later when I started collecting games and kind of looking back on the systems that I maybe hadn't combed through when they were around. Mm-hmm. So for me, yeah, it's been kind of like a series that I visit every once in a while. And Shinobi Legions, like I said before, was definitely very new to me. And but maybe the most interesting Shinobi.
Okay, yeah. Well, I mean, we'll talk about it in the next segment. I remember what I was going to say, and I think it is good for this section. But the more, like, I look at my wall, I own more Sega Saturn games than I do of any other console right now.
Wow.
Nice.
But it's because, they were dirt cheap in Japan. So it's not like first off, if you want to collect Sega Saturn stuff, it's still relatively cheap right now. So I would do it as soon as humanly possible. Start importing that stuff right now. And if you want to look at any games that were released in both territories and you don't need to know Japanese to play it, get the Japanese version. Like 99% of the time, it's going to be cheaper. But the more that I've been owned a Saturn and I've been playing those games, I found that there aren't very many games that I would say are awesome. They're not like must own. Like, this is a system seller. Like, there are no real system sellers for me on that console outside of your diehard arcades and maybe like Virtual Fighter 2 and Virtual Cop and all those games from Sega. But it has so many, like, if you wanted to use like a Metacritic scale, like, it's so many like 80 games, like 75 to 80 games that are just really interesting and quirky. And if you want to sit down and play with them for like half an hour, you'll get a lot of enjoyment out of them. And it's not just like this game, like all the shooters that are on that console, all the different fighting games. And like I said, those things are relatively inexpensive right now. So stop throwing your money away on NES games. And seriously, like, right now, it's not the time to buy NES. Buy some Sega Saturn stuff while it's cheap.
You know, I've got an exception to that, and also a kind of a nice story.
Of course, yeah.
So, you know, you're in Japan, and one of the games I'd asked for you to look for was Street Fighter Zero 3.
Correct.
So, yeah, that game is not cheap. It's not easy to come by in Japan, even. The past few years, and I've been looking, I've not seen a copy in Osaka or Tokyo. And it came in two different versions. One was the boxed one with the cart and the case that's missing the back art and stuff. There's a standalone version. Last week, my girlfriend surprised me with a copy of Zero Three.
No way.
Nice.
Yeah, dude. and that's a game I've, like I said, not been able to find, and it's very expensive on eBay. So I'm finally a proud owner of that game on the Saturn. And that is I'm going to go out on a limb and say one of the best Street Fighters, and the best version is the Saturn one. So
I mean, Alpha 2 is, first off, like, those, you can get copies of Street Fighter Alpha 2 like bottles of water in Japan.
Yes, it's true. Yeah, very, very cheap. But 3 has the three different play styles, and I think a roster that's at least twice as large as 0-2.
You're correct.
And that game, it's one of my favorite games of all time.
Even better than the Dreamcast version.
So the Dreamcast version has more, that has extra modes added to it. Mm-hmm. But I believe the one that is closest to the arcade version is 0-3.
Yeah.
And if there are a lot of people who are very scrutinous over, you know, aspect ratio, animation, frame data and stuff. From what I recall, the Saturn version has more frames than the Dreamcast one, at perhaps slightly a higher resolution as well. Again, I could totally be wrong about that, but there is something about it that's technically superior, even though it lacks the added content of like world tour mode and stuff like that.
I think what you said, Kevin, about the system not having like an amazing library or like a lot of what you would consider system sellers, I think you're right to a point. I think the system doesn't have any like Donkey Kong Countries or Mario's or Sonic's or, you know, like one of those sort of ubiquitous, you know, everybody who plays this is going to like it. It doesn't matter what type of game you like. It doesn't matter what your age group is. Mm-hmm. Like this is the, you need to buy this system because everybody needs to play this game. I think you're right that it doesn't really have a lot of that going for it, but it's got a ridiculously varied library.
Absolutely,
and like,
yeah.
Yeah,
if there's a certain genre, if that genre is on the system, you will find like what you're saying, right? Like Street Fighter 03, great example. But 2D fighters in general, 2D fighters, that system was amazing for 2D fighters, or you know, 3D fighters, especially anything that Sega did. Again, like it's got extremely strong games in a bunch of different genres, and because it was so popular in Japan and not popular anywhere else. It's got a really sort of eclectic library in general, mm-hmm. and it's so completely different from their previous systems because where the Genesis was super popular in the US, completely different style of library than you find on the Saturn. So that's kind of what makes it cool, I think, in a way. It's like there's a lot of really neat hidden gems on that system if you want to take the time to look.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Don't get me wrong. Like I've discovered the joy of the, you know, vertical and side-scrolling shooter from that console because there's very... for someone that needs to have lots of stuff going on and needs it to be very visually appealing, a lot of those games hit it out of the park. And I have so many fighting games on that, on my Saturn. This isn't the Sega Saturn episode, but if
you're turning into one,
we can talk about Shinobi in a second, but, if you just look at for me, and I wanted to save this for even the very last segment talking about news and discussion and stuff, but, and it was funny, just I talked to Mike about this yesterday. We're recording kind of like side by side, but you know, the need to have, if you don't want to own arcade machines, needing to find arcade perfect versions of your favorite games and needing to have the hardware to do it, the Sega Saturn is a great outlet for people that not just want Japanese games, but lots of Western developed games from companies like Midway that put their games out on the Sega Saturn. Like, an arcade perfect version of NBA Jam Tournament Edition for $1 from Japan is worth like $50. It's worth $100 to me to not have a huge NBA Jam cabinet in my house. So stuff like that is why the Sega Saturn is so great. And I guess I would never have thought that I would own. I own maybe like 45 Sega Saturn games now. It's really surprising to me. They're cheap,
I think I'm close to you there. Yeah, they really are. Every time I go, I always come back with about a dozen.
Yeah, dirt cheap. So let's take a break, and we're going to talk about the game that this episode is titled, Shinobi Legions, or Shin Shinobi Den. I think that's a cooler sounding name. When we come back, here's some more music. Is it from the U.S. version? Is it from the European version? The Japanese version? Who the hell knows? It's probably great music, though. Stick around. We'll be right back. Okay, we're here to, for Peter and I, we're here to discover Shin Shinobi Den on the Sega Saturn, and Greg's going to be hanging out to give his impressions to see how the game holds up almost 20 years later. So, Peter, I need to ask you, you mentioned before that you discovered this game as you started to get into the Sega Saturn library, and as someone that is approaching it, 20 years after the fact, after it came out, what are your thoughts? How does it hold up? How does it play? And what was your experience like?
So I would not have played this game if you'd asked me to, like, say a couple years ago. But since getting into the Saturn library, I've realized, like, yes, there are these really, really interesting titles. And I've also come to learn that FMV games can be very entertaining when they're poorly done. So I was kind of excited. I was looking forward to getting into this. And it controlled a lot better than I initially expected. for a game with the digitized, you know, characters for animations. I was pleasantly surprised, I guess, by the gameplay. The design of the game, however, like the stages in terms of just like the things that are there, the length of a stage, and, you know, apart from the Hong Kong harbor, just how sort of drab and boring everything was. That was definitely a hindrance, because I enjoyed playing the game, but it just got so monotonous, I guess. And it never really became an exciting experience until the cutscenes, which I think you'll agree are, yeah, they're bad, but they're very entertaining at the same time.
You can tell exactly what's going on. You don't need to know Japanese to know what this story is. You may have seen it a couple times, but they definitely do an interesting job of displaying that on a Sega Saturn game.
Yeah, and I love the costumes that, you know, like a ninja wearing what are essentially like bell bottoms almost.
Yeah.
And everything like made out of foam. I mean, it was just, you could just tell, like you were saying, that like they had the smallest budget. And
here's $300. Go make all the FMV for this game.
And the CG was so good.
when not to jump in, but when the female ninja gets abducted the second time after you rescue her the first time, she gets tied up with these like laser ropes that are worse. You mentioned Power Rangers, like this is light years before Power Rangers. Power Rangers had way better special effects than this. Like, this is worse than like a 1950s movie.
They had like really thick brushstroke neon green lines in some scenes when, like, you know, powers are being transferred, and then some of the stuff at the end with the CG. Like, I think they were going into the cellular level of Cho, the main character. Yeah. He was learning the ultimate technique and showing how, like, the cells divided and took on this new quality. It was just, I mean, you could see what they were going for, but just there's like nothing like it. It's so strange.
Absolutely. And even there's another part where Shinobi, or the main protagonist, throws his sword through a guy while it is like Highlander, like electricity going through the sword. So this is, I can't, we're going to talk a lot about this game, because I, like you, Peter, I got the stack of whatever it was, 30 something Saturn games when I came back from Japan. And I literally sat on Twitch and I started playing through them one by one to kind of see what grabbed me. And this was one of the last games that I played. And it puts an amazing first foot forward for me, because I go into it and I'm like, all right, we're running at 60 frames per second. Awesome. Kick ass. You know, the graphics are a little bit weird, but every time you attack a dude, you slice them right through the torso and they get cut in half and blood spurts out of their torso. I haven't seen a lot of kung fu movies, but I can best relate it to, like, in Kill Bill, when someone gets like cut in half, like a sword goes through their torso and like all this crazy amount of blood spurts out from them. So, like, this is all right. This is kind of badass. Like, I've tried a lot to play Revenge of Shinobi, and it's just a little bit frustrating for me after the first couple stages. But with this, I'm like, all right, I'm actually kind of moving along. Like, I'm getting through the first couple stages, and yeah, maybe the backgrounds aren't super cool, but I thought, you know, going to the second stage and seeing when you get to the top, you get to see Mount Fuji in the background. That's kind of cool. And, the music is going, you know, it's going well. And I got, you know, my head going up and down, and I'm doing some pretty cool stuff. Also, I'm really bad at using the shurikens. Like, I'd never use them. Like, I don't use them in Revenge of Shinobi or in this game, but you know, your projectiles. But with this, I got to get pretty far in the game before I started having any kind of frustrations, and having a blast doing it. You mentioned the FMV stuff, which is kind of weird, but I wanted to bring up the music for a second, because while it is good, it's like Super Nintendo quality music. Like, you could probably have this music coming out of a Super Nintendo sound chip, at least the Japanese version. And that can be kind of off-putting, because you kind of think of the Sega Saturn and you think that you should be getting some great music out of this. But when we go back to the first segment and we talk about only having 200K of memory, it looks like they did not use actual CD quality audio for this game. They were just kind of processing it through the sound chip itself and using that to produce the music. So I'm not sure about that, but that's what I'm going to guess. The other thing that I wanted to mention is that it feels awesome to be this guy because, like I said, you're slicing dudes in half. You're like reflecting shurikens with your sword. I thought the wall jump is great. It makes Super Metroid look like an Atari game. And there's so many crazy things going on from the different levels. Like the first four levels, you're having different enemies in each one of those stages, like from kabuki faces to soldiers that are just there with all they have is, you know, I got a knife and a rocket launcher, I guess. Like, I think, you know, that makes sense to go attack a ninja with. And there's mutants, there's all these different types of ninjas and stuff like that. And then you get to the fifth stage. That's when this game falls apart for me. Peter, how far did you get before you used codes?
I didn't end up actually using any codes. I didn't actually beat the game.
Oh, it's hard.
Yeah, it gets really hard at the end. I believe I got the last stage I played, it was the Hong Kong Harbor.
You made it pretty far without. Okay, so there's five codes that you need to know for this game. First off is 99 lives, and they knew you were going to have some trouble with this game because the codes are super easy. First off, for 99 lives, before you start the game, you hit AZB, YCX, start. I did that because I'm like, I'm live streaming this game. I'm not going to keep going. And by the way, there's like 6 hours of me playing this game on Twitch with more swears than I've ever had in a live stream. And I apologize for people that were watching that I swore so much, but there was a couple frustrating parts in that game. And there's also level select. So if you ever need to go and do something else, you can always come back and turn on the Saturn and go to the level that you finished off at. And there's also an FMV mode. If you just want to watch the FMV cutscenes of this game, during the intro, press CX, BY, AZ, and then start. You can just watch the cutscenes, which might be worth buying this game for itself. But stage five. And since I had so much, so many difficulties with first the stage four boss, which is very much like the boss in before you go into the dark world of Link to the Past, where you're reflecting the magic of the boss. And you have to time this while jumping up platforms because the platforms are falling down and you know, if you fall down, you get damaged. So you got to keep jumping on these platforms. Some of these platforms will catch fire, I guess, or they will, you know, start causing damage. So you get to jump from platform to platform while deflecting these projectiles that are coming at you. And then you get to the point where that boss splits into two. So you're getting two different projectiles coming at you while these platforms are then turning into flames. So you get to be jumping off them and you get to deflect these things and you can take about 8 hits of damage and then you're dead. So it took me about 28 or 29 tries against that boss to beat him. Then I get to the fifth stage, which, like I said, was the minecart stage. And you have to fight ninjas while jumping from minecart to minecart, very much you're not jumping from cart to cart in Donkey Kong Country, but you need to jump over these barriers. So it's kind of similar in that way. So sometimes you might miss the cart and you'll fall into the water, which, by the way, due to the story, that water was actually contaminated and poisonous. That's why you die immediately. It's not because the ninja cannot swim. I looked that up to be sure. That is a fact in the canon of this game. So I died about 30 times in that stage, I used level select. I went to the sixth stage. That's where you get into a jungle. And I apologize, I'm going to dominate this part for a second, but you get to this jungle and then you got to hang from these vines and you have to make sure to grab them. You have to be pushing up in the D-pad to grab onto them. So you're going to be jumping from vine to vine and then there's endless pit below. There's parts where you need to actually drop down, but then make sure you grab onto a vine that's below you. So you got to make sure you hit up while there's cannons firing at you and there's ninjas throwing stars at you. Don't go too far down though, because there's a pit, so you'll die. And then there's the next stage, which I believe is it's the Hong Kong Harbor, which then there are boats that are spaced far enough where you have to do the double jump. And the double jump is about it's as difficult as it is in Revenge of Shinobi, where you can't just do it automatically. Like, it's not like jump, then jump. You have to time the jump perfectly after you do that first jump to get the double jump. You just won't do it after you hit jump a second time. So then I said, F this, and I unplugged my Sega Saturn, and I turned on my Wii U and played some Wind Waker HD for about an hour on my live stream. So
you have real trouble with the double jump. I watched you play Revenge of Shinobi.
So much trouble.
And once you figured out how to do the double jump, yeah.
Yeah, no, on Shinobi Legions, I had a really hard time with the double jump, to the point where I was sitting there just trying to learn the timing. Mm-hmm. Didn't help.
No, it totally doesn't help. And that's my problem with Revenge as well, because there's times where you need to use that double jump in the, I guess it's the third stage of Revenge, and I just can't do it. And like after the 10th time you fall into a pit, you're like, this is not my fault. Like, I can play this game if it didn't have bad mechanics.
It's totally your fault.
No, it's really not. And the problem is that this game, for the first four stages, it kicks ass. Like, I had so much fun playing this game, like slicing dudes up. I started to memorize the enemy attacks and things like that. So I really had like my good Castlevania mojo going on, where I was kicking everyone's ass. I was doing really well. And then that fourth boss, going into the fifth stage with the minecart level, then going into the harbor, I was just like, no, like, this is, I promise when I did this podcast, I'd only play great games. And the first half of that game is great. It is a lot of fun. The cutscenes are great. But once you get to that fifth stage, this game kind of falls apart. So I'm sorry for ranting there, but I made you guys play this game, so I'm sorry. I don't know, Peter, would you still say check this out? Would you still recommend it, or, you know, any other? I know I just regurgitated a ton of garbage, but I don't know if you what did you think in terms of like how it holds up as a Sega Saturn game, at least?
So relative to the Saturn, I think it really encapsulates a lot of the things that, like, a lot of the qualities of that system and the games that are being made for at the time. Mm-hmm. So as like a little historical sort of, like, you know, touchstone of that era, I would say check it out. If you're looking for like a really fun ninja game, I don't know that I would recommend it. But it's definitely like a moment in time that I think is good. We should remember it and reflect on it once in a while, because it's pretty. Yeah. Like, you know, I did have fun with it at the beginning too, but it's just a very strange game.
Maybe it's just because you're playing a game at 60 frames per second. You're like, oh, I remember that. I mean, I just played Assassin's Creed Unity for like 10 hours at 20 frames per second.
And all told, you got 60 frames at some point?
No.
Like, yeah, all total frames you played for 10 hours, you got 60 frames?
Man, I don't think that game like was at 30 for you know, very much time, but it's not old enough to talk about in this show.
Yeah, I mean, so Shinobi Legion is a very strange game, and if you like strange games, mm-hmm. I think it's worth looking at, especially if you're interested in Sega.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
So Greg, did it, going back to it all these years later, did your impressions change at all? Like, were you able to beat this either? Like, even with 99 no. lives, I did not, I just couldn't do it.
I was not able to beat it, no. But going back to it, it's funny because I told you before, when I played it, I wasn't all that crazy about it. And I think I like it a little bit more now, but only because we're so far removed from when it came out that, you know, I agree with Peter. It's a total oddity, and it's a total example of not only sort of, you know, the weirdness that was the Saturn, but it's indicative of the shift that happened with Sega. Sorry for all the background noise here. The shift that was happening with Sega in the mid 90s, right? I mean, just, there's so many things that are worth seeing in the game, and you kind of look at it and say, this was weird even for 20 years ago, but I kind of like it for that fact. I just kind of like that it's so odd and so different. As far as the gameplay goes, no, it didn't hold up, but it didn't hold up back then either. I always loved that they really seemed to expand what you could do with a Shinobi game, like even little things like having two separate buttons for your sword attack and your shuriken attack.
Or you get to run and then just friggin' slice dudes up when you get that sprint.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, you could do that in Shinobi 3, but yeah, like stuff like that, and being able to do like a sort of a downward thrust when you're jumping, and like all that stuff was pretty new. So there was a lot of really good, interesting play mechanics in there. They just didn't gel into a good game because it felt so sluggish and odd with the digitized graphics. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't hold up, but it's totally a weird, funny, sort of ironically cool game to play nowadays. It's totally worth playing.
It is a cool game game to pull out and, like, you know, turn on your Sega Saturn 4. And you mentioned that downward strike, like, that is fun when you get to, you know, a couple enemies close to each other, and there's even some guys, like, in I think it's the fourth stage where there's this huge blue guy with a whip, and that's like kind of the only way I can really attack him is using like a pogo effect, like a DuckTales, you know, pogo with that down strike to beat that guy. So there's lots of great ways to murder people in this game. I played Grand Theft Auto 5, and that's a pretty violent game, but I've never been more agitated and more violent while playing a game than I have with this in those later stages. So I will just warn people out there about that. You might want to make sure that you can take a deep breath and make sure you have like something like Wind Waker HD to kind of calm you down. I really needed that, and it was very refreshing to do that. So this game runs for about $15 to $20 for a complete copy in Japan for Shin Shinobi Den. In the United States, it's going for about $80 to $100 plus for complete copies.
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, if you want a loose disc, you can pay $40, but yeah.
Holy crap.
I mean, you got to have complete. Well, think about it, Greg. Those Sega Saturn game cases are made out of like fine china.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, they do shatter if you look at them. So
that's why things like that and, you know, Phil's copy of House of the Dead goes for $1,000 on eBay.
This is my Saturn library is my retirement fund at this point.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully we'll not have disc rot ruin that for you, but, we'll see. Not to scare you. Well, man, see, I'm like agitated right now just talking about the end of that game. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a break, and we're going to talk about some more retro game stuff. Lots of cool things coming up in that next segment. So I hope you stick around and you listen to some more cool music from this game, and we'll be right back. So stick around. This is the fantastic last segment where we get to, you know, no matter what, whether the game is good or great that we talk about for the previous hour or so, we get to talk about just fantastic, awesome video game stuff, usually retro-related. So I want to start this off a little differently than I usually do and ask you first, Peter, are you playing any old games for fun that aren't for, you know, work, that you're not writing about, but just... You know, these are games that I picked up, and, you know, they're actually worth playing through today.
You're going to be disappointed in me. No, I'm not.
Well, this is your busy season, man.
I'm playing Pokemon. I finished it for review. I'm still playing that goddamn game.
So it's good.
Yeah, it's a good game. It's, you know, it has its shallow sort of addictive tendencies, but... I haven't played a Pokemon game so maybe this qualifies in a way. I haven't played a Pokemon game since Red. You know, I mean, I was in at the beginning, and then I kind of got out of it. Mm-hmm. It feels nice to play this kind of game again. So maybe I'm chasing that sort of retro feel through a modern game, which honestly is very similar apart from the graphics.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's the same game as Red, right?
Well, it's based on Ruby, but yes, it's essentially yes. I mean, you do the same things. The setup is the same. There's some new mechanics and systems, but the reason you play it is the same reason you play Red. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've always tried to get back. I was like you. I had my Red copy of Pokemon Red with my Red Game Boy Pocket, and me and my buddies got together before school. These were football players, by the way. that I was playing with. Like, these were people on the football team and the basketball team that we played Pokemon together in seventh grade. So we were like, whatever, 13 or something like that. So that was a crazy game. And I will never just be able to get over the awesomeness that was, like, finding out that you could clone Pokemon by, like, disconnecting that link cable.
Right.
So now that you cannot do that today, and, like,
the bunch of cheaters.
What are you talking about? Dude, when you had, like, if you had a buddy that had a Game Shark that could get access to Mew, and then you could just share that, and you just wreck kids, and then you would show it to other kids at school, and they'd be like, "Boy, how did you get that? It's the 151 Pokemon that's, like, supposedly under that van in the game." But like, those are the stories that I just will never be able to replicate. So even after playing Pokemon X for like an hour and a half, I just could not stick with it. It just didn't grab me. But that's a retro game. I'll count that. That totally counts.
All right.
And you did get, you got a bunch of Game Boy stuff through Craigslist. So you got some good deals recently too.
Yeah, $65 got me a Game Boy Color. It was a teal one. A Game Boy Camera, a copy of Wario Land 2, a game called, I want to say, not Tulip.
Yeah, I'd never seen that game before.
Yeah, it's like a weird little puzzle game. Yeah, but then I got box complete copies of Pokemon Blue, Final Fantasy Legend, Mario Golf, and Super Mario Land. And Super Mario Land and Final Fantasy Legend are in impeccable shape. And the guy who I bought this from said, "I bought these in the 90s and just never played them." He definitely played Pokemon Blue because it was a little bit frayed. But I've found like almost nothing off Craigslist recently. Likewise at the flea market. I got a Master System at the flea market not too long ago. Still don't have any games for it, unfortunately.
Does it work?
A lot of eBay things, but
do you know if does it power on?
So I took it apart and I checked all the capacitors and stuff, and you know, there were no dead cockroaches in there. Nothing had fallen off.
They were all still alive.
Yeah. I assume everything works. Jeff Gerstmann, I know, has like a box of Sega Master System stuff, and he brought that in a couple months ago. So I asked him to bring it in, but like anything I ask him to bring in, it takes about a month.
So. It's like a waiting period.
Is this the original Master System or a Master System 2?
The original. And the guy I bought it from said he had the smaller version 2 coming from someone a week later, but never turned up. But I really like the design of the Master System.
It's just wild looking system.
Oh man, yeah, it has that connection diagram for like controller to system to game to your mind, you know?
Here's the schematic you need to run this thing.
I unfortunately got I think it was a fan of my fitness podcast that like found out through something that I said on the show that I liked video games, who sent me a Master System with like 15 games. But unfortunately the Master System, the power supply was dead. So now I just have these 15 Master System games that are just kind of sitting there waiting to be used. And I guess that's a common problem, is that the power supplies kind of go on the Master System. So I will have to track that down or just bite the bullet and get one of the power converters for the Genesis.
I believe the Model 1 Genesis power adapter does work, but you don't have that on hand?
No, like the actual, like the board itself, the
built-in board
one. Yeah.
Oh, really?
Okay. Wow. I guess the board was fried, like it wouldn't even power on, so.
Oh.
That sucks. But I got, you know, Outrun on 18 different consoles now, so that's great. Greg, how about you? You've been throwing in anything into the retro consoles? I know you've been doing stuff for Generation 16 lately.
Yeah, I've been doing some stuff for Generation 16. So, and I have to say, this upcoming episode 14, there's nothing overly impressive in that episode.
What time period are we at right now for the?
We're at the end of 1990. Well, we're in October 1990. Okay. So,
we're getting to some good stuff though.
We are getting into some good stuff, but we're kind of in between the good stuff in this episode because I only do 5 games an episode, and all of these are actually third party. There are no Sega games in this episode coming up. And yeah, there's some really terrible stuff there. But what I've been playing personally is actually Echo the Dolphin on Sega CD.
Oh, wow.
Okay. What? Why?
Well, I sort of started this thing that I do on my Twitch stream every week on Wednesdays. I call it Theater of the Mind. It's just Sega retro games. Mm-hmm. And Echo just kind of happened to be next on the list. And I played it for about 2 weeks. Like, I played it over two nights. And I got far enough that it's like, you know what? I'm going to finish this game. And now I'm in the second last level. It's called Welcome to the Machine, which anyone who's listening who has any memories of Echo, if they got that far, you're probably on the floor shaking in the fetal position right now, because this level is, it's like a 5.5 minute long auto scrolling multi-directional maze.
Jesus.
That if you choose the wrong path, you die.
Of course, you get crushed.
And then you have to do the whole thing over again.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And it's, I archive every Wednesday, I archive what I stream, and then I put it up on my YouTube channel. And of course I did that, and I was checking it out, like just checking to make sure the video was good and the audio was good. And I didn't realize until after that I'd spent over a half an hour of the 1 hour broadcast failing this level over and over and over. And we're talking at like 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes, 3 minutes. So that's how many times I played it.
Dude.
So that's where I am. That's my retro life right now. Also, though, I mentioned I picked up a Turbo Express.
Oh, you got some games?
I only got one game with it. I have a couple Turbo Chip games anyway, but I grabbed Final Lap Twin with it because I've always wanted to play that game. It's kind of this like weird, it's just a racing game, but it's also got like this weird RPG element to it. You actually walk around and like find people to challenge, and every race is done in like a split screen mode. It's really odd, but yeah, anyway. Yeah.
Turbo Expresses aren't cheap.
No, and this one wasn't, but it was cheaper than if I bought it on eBay. I actually went to a local used game shop, which I frequent every now and then, but not a lot. And the reason I went there was just to see, actually, I was doing a Game Gear segment for Generation 16, and I also need an S-video cable for my GameCube. So I was like, well, I'll go check this place out. And I walked in, and lo and behold, they had a TV tuner for the Game Gear, which I couldn't believe they had.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
So I grabbed that.
Are those like really rare or something?
Cause I don't know if they're rare. They're rare around here.
Okay.
And they don't work anymore. Right.
Yeah. Right.
But so I grabbed that, and then they had a Turbo Express, and it's in immaculate condition. And it was less than if you bought it on eBay. It's like, hell awesome. Yeah, I'm grabbing that. When am I ever going to come across that again? So
Yeah, jump on.
I picked one up. So pretty happy with that.
You going to do the HD mod for that?
I'm considering it, because as much as I love that hardware, I'd forgotten how crappy that screen really is.
Oh, no, I meant for the tuner. Going to mod it so you can get some HD television signal.
I'm sure no, honestly, I grabbed it for the footage that I needed for the show, and I'll probably give it to you. I don't actually own a Game Gear, so
yeah.
I'll probably give it to my buddy who owns a Game Gear.
The Game Gear is one of the most unfortunate retro consoles because of how poorly they decline when they get older. So if you're going to buy one on eBay or from Craigslist, make sure you take a very close look at it. Ask them to plug in headphones to the headphone output, because most of the time those fail, and the speakers themselves fail, like the whole soundboard.
It's very common for the screen to fail too.
Yep.
Is it capacitors or transistors or something?
It's the caps. Like you actually have to like buy cap kits for Game Gears now.
Apparently that's a problem with the Turbo Express as well. And that was one of the things I was told when I bought it, because I asked up front, and the guy was like, yeah, this has actually been repaired.
That's good. It
has a cap kit. So
yeah, it's an easy way for systems to die. But if you want to pick up systems cheap that are broken, if that's all you need to replace,
it's not hard to fix.
Costs like $2, $3 at best. A little bit of know-how, and I mean, you've got a system really cheap that you can fix on your own.
Totally.
Unfortunately, that's what got me out of arcade ownership. Like when I was up to 9 arcade machines in my apartment, which is a one-bedroom apartment, one of the monitors, like I think my second monitor went out, and I was like, no. Like at that point, I was like actually going through Clav, which is an arcade forum, to just buy replacement chassis. So I'd buy a repaired chassis for the monitor and then put that in the cab, and then I would sell the broken chassis to try to like get some of the money back, because people will just do that. They'll buy broken, you know, monitor chassis, cap them, resell them. It just was so much hassle, so much to take care of with the goddamn arcade machines. it's probably not worth doing it these days. I will mention that I've been playing, like I said, lots of Sega Saturn stuff, but you know, to be honest, I've been playing lots of new stuff. So people, the new stuff. Oh, my dog even turned on my PS4. That's what the noise is. The fan for my PS4. I can actually hear it.
Oh yeah, that's loud.
PS4s are super loud. I will say, Xbox One, friggin' tang, whisper quiet. So those are great. But yeah, I won't mention anything specifically. But Super Game Boy stuff looks really good through the Frame Meister. If you have one of those, I will mention. And Castlevania 2 on the Game Boy is fantastic. Another thing I wanted to ask you guys is, in terms of, we're getting close to the holidays. But by the time this comes out, Thanksgiving is over. People just, you know, killed each other for Black Friday.
Thanksgiving is over here already.
Whatever. Canada doesn't count. That's not like a real holiday up there, right?
Yes, it is.
Whatever. This is like when the world thinks of Thanksgiving, they think of Walmart and,
that hurts,
and turkeys. But, I want to ask you guys, when it comes to the holidays, because I know I have a couple, like Greg, do you have any games that you like associate with the holidays? Like every Christmas you kind of go back to, and you cannot say Christmas Nights.
Oh, damn it.
That was going to be the game I associated with it.
Well, fine. Let's bring it up because it's never going to be on the show. So the Christmas Nights, I own a copy of that.
Why is it never going to be on the show?
Those games,
you hate Nights?
I don't think those games are good.
Oh, dude. Come on. Oh, yeah, I wanted to point this out too earlier on. You mentioned Richard Jacques, and it's funny because last night you were bitching about Sonic R.
Oh, did
and you
do
know that
too?
He wrote that soundtrack.
Yeah. There was a great article recently about that story, actually.
There was.
Do that. Yeah.
But has he done any good soundtracks?
Yeah, the Shinobi X soundtrack you've been playing.
I didn't play that. No, I played Shin Shinobiden on the white Japanese Sega Saturn console with my fantastic Japanese controller. So, yeah, I own Christmas Nights. I actually own, it's like a 2-pack that came out in Japan, and it was all of 100 yen. It's about what it's worth. And I was playing it, and I just could not do it. It was like a bad Pilot Wings or something like
what?
That.
What?
I don't even know.
Doesn't even make any sense.
It doesn't, but it does. And it's not, it's just like the draw in and stuff like that, the way it controls. I think it was a game that you need to have played when it came out to have appreciation for it. I just don't think I could enjoy it today. And it's so weird.
So
Peter, Christmas Nights, did you actually play this like when it was out?
Yeah, totally. I had a neighbor who I used to play Saturn games with. I mean, Nights and Christmas Nights, I thought were both pretty fine games for the time. I guess today, if you don't have that nostalgia, maybe not.
And it was a free game, right? Wasn't it like?
Yeah, it came with Game Players, Ultra Game Players, or something like that. And wow. I think Next Gen.
Something, yeah.
That's a pretty good deal. It just came and packed in with a magazine?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I think that was the only way to get it here.
Crazy. You couldn't get it at EGM, I guess. Bummer.
All right. Enough of that.
Okay, so I will say my game, and it's why we're playing it on the next episode, is Zelda Ocarina of Time. Like, that is locked in as a holiday game for me because I got that on, spoiler alert for the next episode, I got it on Christmas Eve from my grandmother. She went through the hassle of pre-ordering that game for me, and she got it with it actually came with a t-shirt too for pre-ordering the game. So I first stayed up as long as I possibly was allowed to on Christmas Eve, went to bed probably at like 10 or 11 o'clock, got up at 4:30 in the morning, played that game all morning, did not give a shit about what I got for Christmas because that was it. I got the game that I wanted. So I seem to, every time it starts snowing here in Massachusetts, I start thinking, I think it's about time to play through Ocarina of Time. And now that it's on like 18 different consoles, except the Wii U, you know, you can play it pretty easily. But so maybe that is better context. So I don't know, Peter's... Oh, go ahead, Greg.
I got one that I can throw out there, although it's funny. It has nothing to do with me because my dad was totally against being into video games. So, I mean, he got us our NES, but I don't think he was ready for how into games I was going to be. So he refused to buy us games for Christmas. So, like, all the games we had, we bought with our, like, paper route money and stuff like that. But I had a buddy growing up who he had asked for Batman on the NES for Christmas.
Smart man.
And he had snuck into his parents' closet and found out that he was getting Batman for Christmas. And I used to go up there on the weekends and I'd like sleep over and we play video games all weekend. And he actually got an X-Acto knife and he sliced open this copy of Batman. And we played the hell out of that game for like all of December. And we finished it. We finished the game like a week before Christmas. And then he would put the game back and he would tape up the...
Would you just play it when the parents weren't there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when we were like when I was sleeping over, he had his own like... They had their own sort of rec room that their parents never came into. So we could sit there and play games all.
Honestly, when the parents were there?
His mother would not have known that that was the game she bought.
Oh, right? Really?
So, I mean, she knew she bought Batman, but she's not going to... She didn't know games well enough to glance at a screen and see, wait a second, that's Batman.
It looks just like Michael Keaton.
Yeah.
Turned sideways.
So, I mean, I kind of have memories of that game as far as Christmas goes because we spent the time running up to Christmas playing this ill-gotten Batman. Yeah, but then he put it back in and he repaired the cellophane with scotch tape and either his mother knew and didn't care or he actually fooled her.
Wow.
But yeah.
Oh, yeah. Peter, how about you?
There is no Santa Claus.
No, it's your mom. So, I don't know, Peter, are there any games that you're like, you really associate the holidays with or that you go back to every, you know, this time of the year?
Well, okay, so the first part of that question, the earliest game I remember getting for Christmas was Astyanax on the NES.
Oh, man. I love that game.
Dude, that game is not very good. But
no, not at all.
No, but it's got really interesting. Like, people credit Ninja Gaiden with the cutscene. There were sort pseudo cutscenes in Astyanax. They're very brief, but and the game has pretty interesting music. So, yeah, I got that when I was really young, back when the NES was still a thing. But today any game I would associate with Christmas would have to be Super Mario 64.
Yep.
Totally.
Cause I got that system for Christmas the first year it came out and that game just, you know, that's a timeless game and, definitely spent that Christmas playing with a good friend of mine who was my video game buddy growing up. So I guess that's probably the one game I associate with Christmas.
That's the year that you really found out if your parents loved you or not. If they waited outside like that,
could get one.
If like you think the Wii U was hard, or the Wii, the original Wii, I should say, the N64 was super supply constrained, and not only that, but I've told the story before. Like retailers got away with anything. Like Funko Land charged me $110 for Shadows of the Empire because the games were that hard to find. You couldn't even actually find, you know, the third party games in a store. So they just marked them up, you know, whatever they wanted to do. And I have a similar story to Greg's where, my parents, I think it was the first year my parents started putting the presents under the tree. And, you know, whenever they would leave, I'd like poke around to kind of like see, you know, what a video game box looks like when it's wrapped up. And I was crazy about the N64, like in Nintendo Power at the end of the magazine, they actually had these cards and at the, they had these like playing cards. So, you could actually get like the right number of playing cards and you could win a Nintendo 64. So we were constantly entering that and trying to win one. Of course, on top of that, like being able to go into stores and actually starting to see it there. And then at the local like roast beef sandwich place down the street from our house had a Killer Instinct and a Cruisin' Arcade machine, which were, you know, powered by the Nintendo Ultra 64. So this is something that I absolutely had to have. My parents knew this. And they ended up telling me the story years later where they waited outside Leechmere, which was a department store in Massachusetts. And they waited outside like starting at 4 a.m. to get in line for a Nintendo 64 for me. And they, I'll take a step back. Like I found a game under the tree. I opened it up just enough to see like the side of the box. And I saw it was Wayne Gretzky's 3D hockey. And I felt
that's a shame.
No, that game's awesome. And that game is the best hockey game made up until that point. It was the best hockey game ever made. It destroys 94. So this, I see this game, and this is after my parents have told, like, they actually sat me down. I thought when my parents were getting like a divorce because they were super serious. And they sat me down and said, I know you really, like, you've been really good this winter. Like, you really tried hard in school and you've been really good. Like, I was super well behaved for months because I knew, like, every little bit I could do would help me get this Nintendo 64. And they sat me down and said, we tried so hard, but you just can't get them. Like, they even showed me, like, a newspaper, like, they're just sold out. We couldn't get one. We'll try to get you one next year. You know, we're sorry. So we just didn't want you to get crushed on Christmas Day. I cried that day. That they told me that. And then I saw this Wayne Gretzky's 3D hockey and I thought, oh man, my parents tried so hard and they bought me the game. They didn't get me the Super Nintendo version of Wayne Gretzky's hockey. They got me the Nintendo 64 one and I felt so bad. And then Christmas Day comes and like I go through all my presents and I got a Game Boy game. And that was really about it because I told them, I remember at that time, I was like, just wait, like, don't worry about it. Like, don't spend this money for Christmas. Just wait until they have them. I'd rather just wait and get a Nintendo 64 as soon as they have them in stock. So, that day comes and then I open up that Wayne Gretzky's because I know where it is. And they're like, oh, I guess we'll return it. We didn't know it was the wrong one. And then I'm going to do this to my kids too. My parents come from upstairs down with like a bag. Inside was one more box with another box on top of it.
They like the Christmas Story.
Oh, is that for I've never seen that movie.
That's exactly how the BB gun gets given at the end of Christmas Story. Yeah,
I don't know if my parents like that one or not, but we're more of a National Lampoon's Christmas Vacation family. But the
preach it.
Yeah, they bring it down, and it is a Nintendo 64 wrapped on top of it with a second controller, a red controller, which would be my go-to controller because the gray, stock gray, was not super cool. And
are you a Nintendo 64 kid?
I think he is. I was that kid before that kid was. I was on the East Coast. Like, we just didn't own a video camera. And I ripped that thing open, and that's what it was. It was Wayne Gretzky's 3D hockey and Super Mario Brothers 64 and a Nintendo 64 with two controllers. And that's all I needed. And the next day, we went to Funko Land and got a $110 copy of Shadows of the Empire, which I then played endlessly because of how much I loved Star Wars at the time. But yeah, my parents will always, I always know how much they love me based on the money they spent on me.
That's so funny. That so illustrates the difference in age between you and me, because I remember vividly Star Wars Shadows of the Empire coming out because I had actually was living in New Brunswick. Well, not living. I was staying in a hotel in New Brunswick at the time because the guy who owned the store that I ran in Prince Edward Island was opening a new store in Moncton, I believe. And you're not going to know where any of these places are. But the point is that he needed someone to run it for like the 2 weeks leading up to Christmas. And I was staying in the cheapest little hotel he could find. The room didn't even have a phone. I mean, that's how cheap it was. But it had a little color TV. And we had N64s at work. So I basically took one. I wouldn't rent it out. It was one of the rental units. Mm-hmm. And I went to Toys R Us and they happened to have Shadows of the Empire there, and I bought a copy and I spent 2 weeks playing Shadows of the Empire in that little hotel room while I was running that store.
Great camera, huh? Great camera in that game.
Yeah, I loved that game.
The space action parts of that game were, and it's not just the Hoth level, but all like the stuff that you do in space in your like Millennium Falcon ripoff were a blast. And that last level when you're like basically, it is a structure that you're going to the center of to destroy the core to then escape and then have it explode was awesome. I just always remember the speeder level being a huge pain in the ass. And the Boba Fett, boss battle, super hard. You got to save those photon torpedo things for your gun to the last second. But anyways, man, that's a whole different topic. All right, I think Maybe we're good. Maybe we'll wrap it up there. I will say I picked up a Nintendo DS Lite from China. Don't buy Nintendo DS Lites from China. Even if they say they're legit, they're not.
Okay.
It's all right. I got my money back. Don't worry. I got my money back, and I still get to keep the DS Lite because thank you, eBay. But it's funny. The screens are great. Everything about it is great except the D-pad. The D-pad sucks, which is important for games on the DS. Okay. That's going to wrap it up for this episode of back in my play. Believe it or not, the show is going to be back hopefully next week with another person from Player One, Chris Johnston, and Josh Hillier is going to be back to talk about. Wow. Yeah, remember that guy?
I remember him.
Remember him? Zelda Ocarina of Time. And I think they're playing the 3DS version, but that's not the right way to play it. Come on. You need a rumble pack. You can't rumble on the 3DS, can you? So that is going to be next episode, and then there's going to be some other crazy stuff going on. I'm going to be getting some new people on the show. Thanks to Mike Micah. He forwarded me to some other developers to talk to, so we'll be doing some more interview stuff. And yeah, some lots of great stuff coming towards the end of the year. But before we go, first off, Peter, I don't know if you have anything coming up. I know you got a Pokemon review that will be out by the time people hear this, but anything else that's coming up on GameSpot before the end of the year?
Looking at some new hardware stuff from Alienware, they have a triple GPU $5,000 PC that's the shape of a triangle.
What?
Yeah. And we're also taking a look at it's kind of cool.
Does it stand up as a triangle?
Well, so it stands up on the base. Yeah, I mean, it's got a, you know, there's depth to it, so it'll stay put. It's pretty interesting. But they've also got a what once was a Steam machine, now is not a Steam machine, but it's a small gaming PC that's coming out that's actually pretty good.
Mm-hmm. I want one of those. I know the thing. It's that Alienware thing, right?
Alienware Alpha, yeah.
Yes.
What's the price range on that?
Starts at $550. It's got a modified NVIDIA 860M GPU. And it runs in sort of a console mode, which is a custom shell for Windows that gets rid of a lot of background stuff. And games run about 5 to 25% better in terms of frame rate than they would running it in Windows mode. So it's an interesting little machine. And that's about it. And then I'm going on holiday break.
Good. So, get some rest, man. Play some games. Eat some food. Greg, I know you have more episodes of Generation 16 coming up.
Yeah, I am trying to put almost the finishing touches on episode 14. I'm hoping now to have that out probably the first week of December. I hate to give dates because I always miss them, but looking for the first week of December, yeah. So look for it, generation16.com.
Absolutely, and make sure if you guys enjoy that stuff and get Greg to, you know, make some more of that stuff, make sure you're jumping on that Patreon page. And seriously, like, even if you donate like $1 per episode, get some some funds going that way, because that, you know, talking to Greg, that thing takes a ton of time to produce. So I know for myself, for my other podcast, the incentive to get work done when you know you're actually gonna, you know, you're not just doing it for free, you're investing in equipment and all that stuff. You gotta have some help with that.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. And so it's patreon.com/generation16. And like Kevin said, I mean, it's not to make a profit or anything. It's honestly to put funds back into the show, because I could use better editing software. Mentioned things like that TV tuner and all that stuff to set up for the photo shoot. Mm-hmm. That was all paid for through Patreon.
Cool.
So big thanks to everybody who is a patron. And yeah, if you like what you see, please, even $1 an episode will help.
Absolutely. And for back in my play, don't forget, I haven't been putting episodes up on Patreon, but if you do want to support the show, I will start doing that too. See if we could kind of do the same thing, do some really cool stuff. And I would like to get out to the West Coast to do some more content out there. But you can go to patreon.com/backinmyplay. And probably starting with the last episode, I probably will start using that and see if I can make something cool happen with this. But you can follow Greg at SEWART on Twitter. Peter's at PC Brown. I am at Kevin Larrabee, and of course at Back of My Play. You can check out the podcast on iTunes. I'd appreciate if you submit a review on there if you enjoy the show. We've had some Debbie Downers in the review section lately, who think that I am 14 years old and I haven't played old video games before. So that would be cool if you could jump in there if you enjoy it. Also, lots of other crazy stuff going on. Check out Player One Podcast, and Retronauts is back. So check out Retronauts. If you like retro game podcasts, that is one to definitely check out. Those guys started it. And I will be ready to listen to them. And I know Shane is going to be back on for a bunch of those episodes. And, Yeah, lots of great stuff. So thank you everyone for joining us this week. And my voice is dead, so we will catch you next time. Thank you for listening.